in the afternoon at 3.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
More extracts now from Michael Palin's diaries from 69 to 79, aka the Python years. And a very personal episode today as Michael looks back at his father's final days after a long battle with Parkinson's disease.
In 1966, my parents retired to the village of Raydon, just outside Southwold in Suffolk. Southwold had already played a big part in my life, for it was on the beach here in 1959 that I first summoned up the courage to talk to a tall, slim, mischievous-looking girl called Helen Gibbons. This led to a holiday romance, which led to marriage in 1966, and birth of our son Tom 2 years later. Friday, August the 10th, 1973. I drove up to Southwold and took the old man to Cambridge for a reunion dinner. I looked after him as carefully as I could, carrying his bag into the college lodge as if he were a freshman. Since his coronary in 1964, he's had confirmed Parkinson's disease and has aged very rapidly. His reunion was for all those who'd left Cambridge in 1921 to 1922, so around the lodge had gathered a group comprised entirely of 73-year-old men, all a little rusty and unfamiliar with the proceedings, exactly reliving their first days at the college over 50 years ago. I showed the old man to his room, which was opposite his slightly fitter friend, Clive Bemrose, who'd undertaken to keep an eye on him. I felt very out of place with my long hair and baggy denims. In the quad, a floppy, fattish, rather shambling man with a case as tatty as my father's and a head as bald asked us the way to Thirkell Quad. My father double-took in surprise. "Well, I never, if it isn't my old best man. Bags Cave!" Recognition spread less spontaneously across Bags' face, but at last it came.
"Good Lord! Hugh St. John Gordon. A Palin," he corrected himself.
My father didn't seem to notice anything untoward, so pleased was he to encounter Bags. It was like listening to Shakespeare's characters, silent and shallow.
"How are you, old boy?"
"Oh, wilting a little, old boy,"
said Bags sadly, and started talking about hospitals. Being back in Cambridge transformed and inspired my father. The joy for him at his age is in its lack of change. It doesn't disorientate him, as other cities do, for he can still see many, if not all, of his old haunts. 2 days later, on the 29th of July, it was my sister Angela's 40th birthday, and we went down to Dulwich for lunch. We lay in the garden and drank sherry, and I tried to take a few photos, as it was one of those very rare occasions on which the whole family was all together. It occurred to me what a polite lot we all are. I can remember Angela's childhood being punctuated with violent rows and shouting matches. I can remember many occasions when I hated my father for his intolerant, irrational rule-making and his surliness to my friends, but now, with age, we've all mellowed. More optimistically, there doesn't seem to be any repetition in Angela's or my family of the lack of contact between father and children which we experienced. Friday, December the 28th. On Christmas Eve, collected Dad and took him to an afternoon carol service at Westminster Abbey. It clearly is a great source of pleasure to him to sit in the Abbey for an hour. I left him there and drove around Westminster. Saturday, March the 16th, 1974. Dad was seen last night by a psychiatrist from St. Audrey's Hospital in Woodbridge, and his condition was serious enough for him to be taken in first thing this morning. It sounds as though his brain is now so affected by the Parkinson's that he may never see Croft Cottage again. I rang my mother this evening. She sounds relieved that he's at last being properly looked after. But even so, she misses him. Thursday, April the 11th, Southwold. When Helen, Angela, mother and I arrived at St. Audrey's Hospital, Dad was sitting watching TV. He seemed to be genuinely pleased to see us. He was in day clothes and looked 100% better, though a little stooped and his eyes were moist. Fortunately, due to his much improved state, I was able to talk quite matter-of-factly about the problems of getting out. He wants to go home. Everything he says is geared to his release from this institution, as he calls it. He's tried to get out twice and has been discovered by nurses halfway down the stairs. One nurse was treated to a volley of abuse when she tried to stop him. But today he was negotiating tenaciously with me, like an ageing politician trying to strike one last bargain, pull off one last coup. Easter Sunday, April the 14th. Drove over to St. Audrey's after breakfast to bring Dad home for the day. It's nearly a month since he went into hospital. Took him some clothes and a box of chocolates for the nurses. They dressed him behind some screens while I spoke to Mr. Smy, the charge nurse. We were talking fairly softly, but when I mentioned that recently Dad had been very confused, there was a shout from behind the screen, "I'm not confused!" Sun shining as we drove back to Southwold. The countryside looked fresh and green. A great day for colours, heavy dark shadows on the pine trees, and a vivid, almost luminous green on some of the fields. At 6:30, Mother and I drove him back to the hospital. Monday, April the 15th. After lunch, built a new piece of fence for Mother, while she and Helen sorted through an old chestful of Father's papers. Letters from Shrewsbury home to his parents. Old school reports. Indian railway timetables. Dance cards from Poona with the names of his partners for the evening marked. In the 1920s, my father spent 5 years in India, working as an engineer on various public projects, including the Sukkur barrage across the River Indus. He was always very proud of that. A fascinating collection, much evidence that he was quite a character, enjoyed life and was sociable. "Always looks as though he's done something wicked, but never has," in a school report from Shrewsbury. Thomas and Willie love his old bundles of cheques, and Thomas has taken to playing bank managers. Wednesday, June the 12th. Caught the 9:30 train and breakfast to Ipswich. Father and Mother on the platform at Darsham. At first appearance, my father, who 3 months ago seemed quite seriously ill, looks extremely fit and well. Very suntanned and, though a little stooped, certainly not the shuffling wreck he'd been in St. Audrey's. His mind seems stronger. He can understand more and his recent memory is no longer so clouded. Also, his hallucinations have stopped. All this since he'd been taken off the wonder drug L-Dopa. After lunch, dressed crab and Adnams beer, I took him for a drive, which was quite successful. Again impressed by the improvement in his mental condition. The awful twist being that this improvement makes him more aware of his physical deterioration. We drove through sunlit Suffolk lanes, with lush green countryside almost overgrowing the road on either side. Ended up at the Harbour Inn at Southwold. The sky was a perfectly clear azure blue above the sea. Southwold looked clean and brilliant, like a newly wrapped present. Tuesday, August the 6th. Father went into hospital at St. Audrey's again for a 2-week period. He's seeing hamsters everywhere now. They squelch under his feet as he walks in the sitting room. My mother has to carry a bag to put them in. When the doctor arrived, the hamsters got up Dad's trousers and began to attack his privates. My father, so staid and unimaginative over most of his life, is now becoming quite pythonic. The hamsters seem to bother more than frighten him, as do the two men who've evidently been in the garage since 1966. Thursday, May the 8th, 1975, Southwold. A perfect May morning, a slight haze clearing away from the trees and fields in the distance. Father had given me an excellent birthday present, conceived, bought and wrapped entirely by himself. It was a big Adnams poster showing all their pubs, and we used it to find the Wherry Inn at Gelderston. We were able to sit out in the sun with beer and sandwiches, a friendly pub in a friendly village. A trip which cheered us all up, and Father is rarely cheerful these days. I went for a walk last night with him, and he told me he really would like to be 75. And after that, he doesn't care. Saturday, April the 23rd, 1977. Woken at 7:15 by Tom telling me the phone was ringing. It's Mother. Father is not expected to live much beyond lunchtime. I promise to get up there as soon as I can. Tell the children. Willie says quite seriously that he hopes Rachel, who's got a slight cold, won't be dead by lunchtime too. My sister Angela and I arrive at Blythburgh Hospital just after 11. As we walk from the car, neither of us, or certainly I myself, have any real idea of what to expect. I've never been near anyone dying before. Mother sits at the bedside, hardly racked with grief. Indeed, she greets us very matter-of-factly, as if we just arrived at a coffee morning. A marvellously sane and intelligent middle-aged lady doctor takes us into her room. She can't give us any real estimate of how long Dad will live. So on her advice, I take Ma, who's been at his bedside for 5 hours, back to Raiden, where we do a bit of shopping and have some lunch. As we really don't know how long he'll survive, it's decided that I shall go back to London and Angela will stay with Mother, at least until Monday. On the way back, I stop at the hospital. I'm 33 and he's 77 when I last see him, an emaciated shadow of the father I knew. Say goodbye to the nurses. One of them says he'd really grown to like my dad, which is nice because it didn't happen like that often in his life. I must have been passing Colchester when Father died, at 7:25. Mother and Angela were almost at Blythburgh, slowed down by heavy rain. He was dead by the time they got there. Sunday, April the 24th. I have to travel to Durham for the filming of Ripping Yarns. Armed with unlearnt script and the Sunday papers, it's only as we pull out of King's Cross that the pressure of events in the last few days hits me with a wave of depression. I miss home and family. I've seen so little of them for the last 2 weeks. I feel, too, the sadness at my father's death, which eluded me yesterday. It's a feeling of loneliness, a feeling that I'm speeding away from the familiar world, which for some reason I need at the moment, to an unfamiliar world of new faces, new people, new work. And the skies turn greyer, too, increasing the melancholy. Saturday, April the 30th, Southwold. We troop off to the church in time for the service at 2. Father had been cremated at Galston during the week, so it's more of a memorial service than a cremation. Father's ashes are in a small wooden box at the end of the aisle. The service goes well, as does the vicar's little address about my father being a man of patience, bearing with extreme tolerance and fortitude the slings and arrows. I suppose in a sense he was patient, for a man carrying a severe stammer for much of his life. I just remember so many moments of impatience and intolerance. At the end, we process out behind the box of ashes and into the churchyard. His ashes are lowered in, dust to dust, and the ceremony is over. Father would have loved the church today, filled with sunlight, the medieval pews and the fine old screen which has witnessed funeral services for 500 years. Back to Croft Cottage for tea. Mother quite composed about the whole thing. Tea turns into a jolly family reunion in the best tradition of funeral teas. And we leave for London at about 5.
Episode 3 of the Michael Palin Diaries, The Python Years, was abridged by Loris Morgan Griffiths and produced by Louise Armitage. Tomorrow, an Andy Warhol party in New York and a memorable TV appearance with some very unhappy cats.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock on Wednesday, Wes Butters with drama next as we're plunged back into wartime London with the second half of Elizabeth Bowen's novel, The Heat of the Day. And I hope you're sitting comfortably because after that on today's 4 o'clock show, Mel Gedroych is hearing all about the man who made his own underpants out of nettles. No, it's not a joke. There isn't a punchline, I don't think. We'll hear more at 4 o'clock. Now, the concluding part of our drama set in London and Ireland during World War II, and here's the story so far.
Hello, Mrs. Rodney?
Yes?
It's Harris. Listen, I would like to come and see you, actually. Have a word. There is something really quite important to talk about. How about...
What do you mean? What do you mean, important?
Your friend Robert's been playing the fool. As you know, he's at the War Office. That's probably all you do know, but I know a little more than that. He's working for the enemy. And what I'm saying is this, what finally happens to him rather depends on me. Or when I say it rather depends on me, I mean it rather depends on you. Do you see?
Mr. Morris left all his estate to your son, Roderick. There is an existing trust for his widow, of course, but apart from that, the house in Ireland, land and capital, go to your son. This is a copy of the will. As he's still under 21, you are, of course, his guardian.
What I don't like is you going away at all.
I'd no idea you were going to feel like this, because what does it amount to? Simply a business journey. Roderick's Mount Morris affairs. Somebody's got to get over there. He can't. I must.
And what will you do while you're away? Will you keep loving me?
I'll keep loving you.
The Heat of the Day, from a novel by Elizabeth Bowen, based on the screenplay by Harold Pinter. Episode 2. Exterior, Mount Morris, Ireland, 7 p.m. The house is large. A girl stands on the steps. A pony and trap comes down the drive and stops. Donovan, the butler, comes forward.
Let me help you down, ma'am. This is Mary, my daughter. She'll take your cases.
Interior, Mount Morris Library. A large, dark picture. White cards stuck around the inside frame. Stella walks forward and peers at the cards.
Locks and hinges, my method of oiling. Live mice caught in traps to be drowned, not dropped in kitchen fire, in case of blocked gutters, in case of parachutists, in case of my death.
Stella turns away, a fire blazing in a distant marble fireplace. She looks out of the window. Donovan comes into the room with an oil lamp. He turns the wick high. The globe wells up with yellow light. Mary Donovan enters with another lamp. The two globes are reflected in the window panes.
This has been a bare sort of time for us, ma'am, with neither master, and it's a poor welcome for you, I fear, but indeed, you're welcome.
Thank you.
We killed a little chicken for your supper.
Oh, how nice.
Will you see your room? Are the candles, Mary?
There are two candles above.
Exterior, Mount Morris, 10 p.m. River flowing, moonlight reflecting.